Hello, I'm Andrew Fuller. I'm the chairperson of Generation Next, and in this series of podcasts, I get the privilege of talking to great experts in their areas on mental health, well-being, and generally young people, although sometimes people of broader age groups as well. And today, I'm just delighted to talk to Tara Hunter. Tara is the Director of Clinical and Client Services at Full Stop Australia, and has a long history of experience in working in preventing and also intervening after sexual assault. So today we're going to talk a little bit about some of the latest trends in sexual assault, and then we're going to delve into the world of relationships and what are some of the red and green flags that we can help young people to identify, hopefully early, and also think about that rather convoluted and sometimes complex world of consent, and then really delve into what do we do and how can we be helpful when a young person tells us that they are being sexually harmed. So welcome, Tara. Can we begin by just giving a little bit of a snapshot in terms of just some of the latest trends in terms of sexual assault, please?
Yeah, so Andrew, thanks for having me along. This is a really relevant topic for young people because what we see in the data is that young people are absolutely overrepresented in terms of being victims of survivors of sexual assault and sexual violence, but they're also the cohort that are from 15 to 19 that are also the highest rate of perpetration of sexual violence. So again, breaking that down, when we look at sexual assault and sexual violence, it is absolutely a gendered crime. So the majority of people that are experiencing that violence are young women, but that is not to say that you're not going to see young men that are affected or victims of sexual violence. And we also know that this is a crime that is mostly 97% of perpetrators are male. So it is a gendered crime. So that's something just to really keep in mind in terms of looking at vulnerabilities. But when we're talking about young people, we're also considering that young people may have histories of child sexual abuse. And we look at also abuse that may be happening in institutions like schools, like sporting clubs, where there may be a special care relationship, a responsible adult that is also grooming or perpetrating that sexual abuse. So it's quite a complex space. We look at also that this is a crime that is really underreported. So often what you're dealing with is young people that may be impacted. It might be something that it's experienced, say, in a social setting, and it might be a peer-based relationship where there's non-consensual sex. But that young person may not be coming forward. The other thing that I know from my clinical experience is this has really lasting impacts on young people. So the first thing that we might notice for someone that's experienced sexual violence or sexual assault is that they may not be coping very well. So they may be having anxiety, low mood, not participating as they have previously. So they might be some of the indicators that something's happening for that young person.
Thank you, Tara. Yeah, so of course this interlinks with what we all desire, particularly when we're teenagers, relationships. And so let's take it a little bit back from sexual assault, but what really are the red and green flags about what signifies to young people a good relationship versus one that's looking a bit kind of mm-mm?
So let's start with the positive, because I think it's really important in this space. I often feel like I'm the bearer of bad news. So I think young people can have really healthy, happy relationships. And as you say, they're foundational to people's well-being. So some of the green flags that we would be seeing are things like, open communication, equality. So really, actually, regardless of the gender of the person, that they're is some equal engagement around who is making decisions and how, you know, the how things are going forward. If we're looking around sexual relationships engagement, so there's consent and discussion around what happens in that sexual relationship, and there's choices around who does or doesn't do something. I think the other bit is around when young people are in relationships, it's also about that capacity for them to have broader friendships. So we don't want to see, one of the red flags we might see is when a young person is in relationship and suddenly they're being isolated from their friends and family. To me, that's a really big, that can be a really big red flag. The other kinds of things that might be indicators that things aren't going so well is really constant communication around, like texting, wanting to check. So say if you went out with your group of friends and then your boyfriend texts you constantly while you're there, what are you doing? Who are you with? You need to come home. So they're some of the things that we would start feeling worried about. When someone is threatening or coercing. So, and that might be things like, look, if you don't do this, I'm actually going to tell people about, you know, something that we've done sexually, or they may well reveal secrets or confidences that have been shared in the context of that relationship. So when we start seeing that kind of threatening and coercive behaviour, or someone always being in charge, no, we're not doing this, and someone always having control of what's happening in the relationship, that's when we see red flags. And obviously at that extreme and actually criminal end is where a young person is being coerced into doing things sexually that they don't want to do, or that if there's the sharing, say, you know, and we know that is quite common for young people to share images and intimate images, but if that gets shared beyond that without that person's consent, again, there's some real control happening there and worrying behaviour.
Thank you, Tara. And that sort of brings us really to that kind of fairly intricate world of consent and affirmative consent. Would you care to try to unravel that for our listeners? Because it can be complex.
Yeah, look, it often does feel very complex, but actually I'm going to try and make it really straightforward for you today. And my area of expertise and where I've practiced is mostly in New South Wales. So more recently, and there are a number of states that have affirmative consent laws, and we're hoping that that actually makes some of that grey space a lot clearer. But really, when we're talking about affirmative consent, so or any kind of consent, it's free and voluntary agreement around each and every act. So and that the people participating in those acts can withdraw their consent at any time. And so what we see in a relationship, just because someone says, oh, I'll go home with you, or I'll be your girlfriend, does not mean that they have consented to anything other than, you know, being a girlfriend. If they've consented to go into a room with someone at a party, that doesn't mean that they've consented to sexual intercourse. It means that they've gone into a room, and they've then what happens from there is that there needs to be a discussion where both parties agree to what happens next. So, good example, is it okay if I kiss you? Are you comfortable for me to take your shirt off? And so we go on. Mm-hmm. But every part of the activity needs either verbal or, you know, physical indication that that person is enthusiastically saying, yes, wanting to do this. The other aspects we need to think about is if someone's highly intoxicated or unable to make, you know, to actually verbally say yes, then that is an act where there's no consent. And it's really clear in the law that if someone's intoxicated and unable to say yes, then you should not be having or continuing sexual activity with that person. So in a situation where, say, someone's using alcohol or taken drugs and you might be halfway through sexual activity, but that person then becomes, you know, unconscious or passes out, then you should stop what you're doing.
Thank you. That's really clear. So let's move now to basically the role that we're all sometimes sadly in, which is when we're working with a young person and they tell us that they are being sexually harmed in some way. What are your initial thoughts about the role of us workers in terms of helping those people?
Yeah, I think the first thing I'd say is when we sit in that, and it's a hard space to be in, but it's also a really privileged position, and we need to honour and respect that we've been chosen as a safe person to be told this information. And in responding, it's really the essential response is that we believe that person, so that we actually acknowledge and we say, you know, thank you for sharing that information. That sounds like it's really difficult. The first thing I need to let you know is that I believe you, and the next thing we need to do is say, what do you want from here, in terms of there probably needs to be better words than why did you tell me, but it's about saying, so what can I do to support you with this information? For some young people, it might be that they just need to tell someone. They don't necessarily need you to fix things or run off and make a whole lot of interventions. It's about trying as best we can to work with that young person and give them a bit of control back. So when we look at abuse and sexual violence and sexual assault, what happens is that person's control and power has been taken away from them. So when we look at that trauma-informed response, we need to think about that, the safety and well-being, but we also need to think about giving that person some choice or collaborating with them, rather than saying, I'm the adult, I need to make the decisions, you know, and having the runaway freight train. That said, I do need to acknowledge that depending on the age of the person and the context of that sexual abuse, as a professional, we also have a duty of care for the safety and well-being of that young person. And we also have mandatory reporting obligations. Depending on what state you're in and, again, what context you're in, you may have a whole range of obligations which require you to share what that young person has shared with you beyond that room. And so in that space, what is really important is about being transparent. It's about saying, again, thank you for telling me. This is the information I can keep private. I need to let you know this is my duty of care in sharing X, Y, and Z information. These are the things I can tell you will happen next. These are the things I don't know. You know, if I make a mandatory report, I'm unsure about what they will do with this information. But what I do know is that when they make a mandatory report, particularly for a sexual assault matter under 16, that will be assessed by a health worker, by police, and by a child protection worker. And from that assessment, there will be potentially, you know, further action. So So we need to just be clear around what we know and what we don't know, but also offering, obviously, support to that young person around walking beside them through that process.
So possibly more murky is the area of letting parents know, particularly for workers who are in schools or teachers. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can, with a disclaimer that I acknowledge that in schools and the Department of Education have their own guidelines around what is required for a teacher. And my understanding is, for a young person under 18 or a school goer, that they will have to make some sort of mandatory report, and it is likely that they will need to talk to parents around what's happened. In a health setting, you have a bit more leeway in terms of this. If someone's 16 and over or a mature minor, then we don't necessarily need to engage parents in that young person's care if we know they can consent to it. So I think one of the things we need to know is, if we're saying to a young person, part of our process is that we might need to talk to your parents, how might that be for you? It's actually about, if that young person is really reluctant, it's actually about taking some time to unpack and understand why that young person is reluctant for that information to be shared. And some of the reluctance might be that the parent, they know that the parents will be non-believing, they feel that the parent, they might be in trouble because of the context of the assault. But it might also be, we know that that children can also be in a situation where they're being harmed in their home. So not all parents are safe, unfortunately. So it's about finding, if it's not a parent that's safe, it's also about saying, who are your safe adults in your life? That if we need to tell your parents, are there other people that we can maybe engage as well that feel safer for you and that might be an ally? And I'm not recommending that we split in families where possible. We really want parents engaged because, yes, they're the person that's supporting that young people, they're supporting the young person in the best way they can. So it's also about linking parents with the right support. So if I think about an organisation like ours at Full Stop Australia, we have a 24-hour phone line and we're able to provide support to family and friends as well. So it might be that we're making the right referral to say, look, we need to talk to your parents. Let's plan for the worst scenario, but let's make sure also that we give them the right information where they can have, they can have the conversations with a healthcare provider or with a professional so that they're getting their own support.
So you've been working with a young person, they've revealed that you've perhaps talked within a school or your setting and also met perhaps the parents. Where your initial referral options, what would you recommend for anyone really?
Okay, so there are a whole range of options in that context. And again, I'm a big fan of giving young people choice. So within the school setting, sometimes the young person actually feels really safe with the school counsellor. And so that the school counsellor may well, if they don't feel as well resourced or experienced in the space around sexual violence or sexual assault, they can engage with, again, an organisation like ours, Full Stop, and get some support from our trauma specialist counsellors. There's also in sexual assault services, and they are set up in different ways all across Australia. So particularly if you're dealing with a more recent assault, then there's a recommendation, again, I can talk from a New South Wales perspective, that all local health districts, you can go to a hospital, there will be a service within your local health district where you can, if it's within the last 7 days, receive a 24-hour response from a doctor and a counsellor. But they also provide ongoing counselling support. So they're a really good option. They're free, and they're depending on their resourcing, they may also be able to provide one-off support for parents as well. And then, depending on where and what the choices are around that young person, they may already be having psychological support, so they may just want to go into an organisation like Headspace or have some private care. So there are a whole range of options. Sometimes that in itself can be really challenging to navigate. So that's where, again, I would recommend contacting somewhere like Full Stop or a specialist sexual assault service to get some advice around what the best options are.
Thank you. That's really clear. And you've done all of that. And I guess there's a real need to realise that this sort of work has an impact on us. And how do we, as best we can, after having gone through that with a young person, take care of ourselves, do you think?
Yeah, I think the first thing to acknowledge is the concept around vicarious trauma. So we know that if we are exposed to other people's trauma content, that can have impact on us in terms of actually experiencing a whole range of things like sleeplessness, anxiety, low mood, not wanting to engage in work. And that can happen if we're exposed to, so if we're working in this space all the time, hearing people's distressing material, that cumulative effect can take place. But even if we've just got, even if we've heard, as you say, gone through one process with a young person, this is, as I've stepped out, it's quite a complex space, but it's also distressing to hear a young person story around being harmed. It's not okay. And sometimes we, because the system can be challenging, we can feel a little bit powerless ourselves. So really important to have supervision, both formal and informal. So again, I'll do a plug for our organisation. We provide, debriefing and support for a whole range of professionals, teachers, school counsellors, psychologists that might work in this space. And so it might be that if you're finding that you just want to talk through what happened. And I guess, again, in my experience, often people are doing all the right things, but it might be at the end of the day, they just need to finish off the day to actually have a conversation with someone to say, I've just had this case. These are the things that I've worked through. Have I done the right thing? Is there something else that I need to do? And in being able to have that conversation, it's about kind of finishing up the day and putting that file away or putting that case away as best you can. So that would be a more informal thing. I think if you're finding that you're having the kind of the thoughts around this case or particular cases coming up and that are intruding in your non-work time, again, I'd really encourage to get psychological support. In terms of your self-care, everyone has different versions of that. I'd really encourage, all those basics around things like going for a walk. Sometimes, that's one of my favourite things is at the end of the day, I just go and walk off whatever I've had to deal with in the day. Having a space where you go into where you're not talking about and thinking about work. So really trying to leave work at home. Meditation, whatever kind of, this is such a personal space, but I guess, again, as professionals or people working in this sort of space where they're dealing with difficult issues, is that you actually have professional supervision, and part of that is setting up some self-care strategies. So you've got your go-to. If you've had a hard day, oh, I'm going to go for a walk today, or I need to write this down in a journal, or I really need to make sure that I've booked in for my yoga class on the weekend. So they're just, I guess, I've always when I'm supervising social workers, either students or, you know, professionals, I will always say, this is part of your self-care and looking after your well-being is part of your professional life. So it's part of your work and you need to factor that in somewhere.
I think sometimes it's important just to remember that there are more healthy relationships than unhealthy ones in the world. And I think
because you can
take a bit of view of this world sometimes. And the other one was just to think you've just played a very hard but important role in the first step of somebody recovering from a dreadful situation. And that's a really noble role, isn't it, to take on that first step in recovery is so important. And clearly that young person trusted you enough to confide in you, which I think is an honourable thing.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, when we talk about vicarious trauma, we also talk about vicarious resilience and that sense of, you know, making meaning of what you're doing and actually highlighting, again, as you say, this kind of space where you're going to be hopefully and a really important first step in people getting a safe response. Because what we know is if people receive that first safe response in the first instance, they're more likely to engage in an ongoing way. So it is sort of taking some of the highlights around going, okay, well, I might not have fixed A, B, and C, but what I have done is sat with someone and been a safe space for them to talk about something that's really difficult. And I don't think we as workers often give enough recognition or acknowledgement for that, that sitting with difficult stories is actually really powerful for the person disclosing that information.
Thank you, Tara. It's been a wonderful conversation and I really want to honour the work that you do. It's remarkable and so, so important. Is there any way that listeners, if they want to follow up with you, can get in touch?
Yes, so look, the best way to make contact with us is through we're 1800 full stop. So you can either phone through our phone line or through our website. We have online counselling. But if you actually wanted to, and we do have a range of resources and information about how, again, how to be a tellable person, how to respond to a disclosure with compassion, where to go for ongoing support, including our organisation. If you want to, we also do a lot of training in this space around vicarious trauma and worker wellbeing, but also, again, responding to disclosure. So on our website, we have a whole lot of training information as well. If you needed to contact me directly about anything in particular, you can just go through, there's a web form and you could just say, you know, I wanted to make contact with Tara Hunter and that would find me through that process as well. But we will, as part of, I can provide you with some just brief information as well to go alongside the podcast if you'd like.
Thanks so much, Tara. That'd be really helpful. Thanks so much again.
Okay, thank you.
Find more resources for supporting the mental health and well-being of young people on the Generation Next website. While you're there, consider becoming a member of the Online Learning Hub, where you can access practical sessions from leading experts on demand. There are many sessions available in the ever-expanding learning library, and each session has an instantly downloadable certificate of completion, which you may even be able to use to claim professional development. You can also feel great about your membership, with all proceeds supporting Generation Next's not-for-profit initiatives, including this podcast. You may also like to read more in Generation Next's Young Minds books. Both books contain practical and easy-to-read chapters on a range of topics from Australia's leading practitioners. Andrew Fuller's chapter, What is Resilience and How to Do It, is in the book Growing Happy, Healthy Young Minds, available on the Generation Next website at www.generationnext.com.au. We hope you found this podcast helpful. Please share this podcast and your learnings with others. Until next time, thanks for listening and for all you do to support young people and our communities.